This is Ingrid Robbins from Erasmus University of Rotterdam, and she's going to talk today about whether the traditional gender division of labour can be justified. And I'm really interested to find out what she concludes about it.
Shall we do a how do you call this, a gamble, but that we put in money and then if you're right?
Yeah. No, I'm not better because I don't.
Actually, there should be a correction. I'm not giving a seminar tomorrow. I'm attending a seminar that will be
given by the students.
Okay, something good. Like that. Okay, so I actually changed the title a little bit from the, I think I announced it as the unequal gender division of labor into the traditional. You will see that the traditional is actually one version of the unequal. Unequal just means not equal, and the traditional is the one whereby women do more unpaid work, men do more paid work, but it, we can discuss this in the question. I think it's presentation-wise easier to do it like this, and we can discuss it, the broader question, later on. So, why do I ask this question? Why do I think this is a question worth asking? Because I've noticed that there are two conflicting views on the question of the traditional gender division of labor. One is among, I just call them feminist scholars, broadly defined, or feminist activists. They think it's obvious that the traditional gender division of labor is unjust. And they also actually have told me, why do you need to write a whole paper about this? But on the other hand, there are many other scholars, and actually many, many people in society who ask, well, what's wrong with the traditional gender division of labor? So there seems to be a sort of an... people have beliefs about this that are strongly conflicting. And the reason why I think feminists are wrong in thinking that it is obvious is that they have done the analysis for themselves. They think the analysis they do, they conduct is valid. But my assessment of the normative philosophical literature is that we haven't done enough work in really arguing why the traditional gender division of labor is, well, it's not so much arguing that it is unjust, but asking the question, is it unjust? I know there are people who've done this, most famously, I think Susan Okin has done path-breaking work in this area, but if you look at some recent statements from famous political philosophers, you will see that they are not convinced. So basically, I want to make a new attempt in making an analysis to the best that I can do of asking this question, answering the question, is there anything wrong with the gender division of labor? And so yes, what precisely is wrong with it? So, as I said, that's the aim of the paper, to analyze whether it's wrong, unjust, and why. I use the term traditional gender division of labor for a division of labor within heterosexual households, so households where you have a man and a woman. So that means I exclude gay households, which actually we know from literature have much more egalitarian divisions of labor, and also single parents, because there is nobody to divide the household work with. And with traditional, I do not only mean a kind of a breadwinner model, whereby you have the father who works and the mother who's at home, but also the more recent versions whereby fathers work more for money, work more on the labor market, and women may have a small part-time job or may have jobs once in a while, but the primary responsibilities are that men provide the money by working on the labor market, and women provide for do the unpaid household work and caring for children and other dependents. One thing that I will do in this paper is, and that I hope will get us further than we are in the literature so far, is by making a distinction between a societal gender division of labor and a household gender division of labor. With household, I just mean take one household and look at how they've divided it up. So that's just like a sort of an individual unit. The societal gender division of labor is what we see if we aggregate. So what is the way at the societal level people tend to divide up the labor within the household? This is how I will present the analysis. I will first very briefly give you some stylized facts about the gender division of labor in what I called here affluent post-industrial societies. So the geographical scope of my talk is basically North America, Europe, Australia. So basically post-industrial societies where a certain level of affluence is reached. So I will first give you some stylized facts. Then I will conduct an evaluation or an assessment that looks at the outcomes of this division of labor. I will ask, so we have this division of labor, what are the consequences? Next, I will ask at the level of ideal theory, which conditions should be met for a societal gender division of labor to be just? And then I will look at the empirical studies and ask whether they are met. And I will come to the conclusion that they are not met. However, Philippe van Parijs has objected to this kind of analysis, and he has provided an argument against the analysis that I will present. So I will respond to his objection, and I hope that it thereby that I thereby conclude the analysis. And in the last section, I will ask what the consequences then are for households. So the analysis will actually most of the time be conducted at the level of society, and I think there is something to be gained by doing that analysis, but then at the end asking, so but what does this mean for individual households? So first, the stylized facts. I'll be very brief because they don't matter actually too much for the analysis. The traditional gender division of labor, as I described it, is the dominant form of the way households organize their work. Not only the breadwinner model is in decline, but especially the division whereby men have full-time jobs and women have part-time jobs is an increasingly common way to organize work within the households. We know from empirical research also that in the last decades, women have done more and more paid work, but if you look at time budget studies, that work, the time that they used to do more paid work, has been drawn from decreases in their own unpaid work, especially household work. Actually, women, as in Europe at least, I don't know the figures for the US, they don't do less caring work, they don't spend less time with their children, but they just do massively less household work. Less cleaning, less cooking, less whatever, and more paid work. In virtually all these rich countries, full-time working women put in the most total hours of all groups, more than part-time working women, more than full-time working men, and they enjoy the least leisure. So there is a certain cost for women if they decide to work full-time. Because what we do see is that the increase in paid work by women has not been matched with a similar increase in unpaid work by men. The younger generations are more egalitarian, so we see especially before there are any children, actually there is rough egalitarianism. So as long as couples don't have children, they manage quite well to be egalitarian. When the children are born, that's the point when things change. However, the change, especially when you also look at what happens when they have children, is smaller and slower than people often assume. That's actually not my statement, but it's a statement by sociologists who've studied this. And also, quite a number of scholars have commented that there is a broad subscription to the values and the ideology of gender equality, but that in reality, couples do not live up to those principles. So there are studies where they ask people what they think should be the case, what they think they do, and then they have these time budget studies that they put next to it, and people believe they're more egalitarian than that they are within their households. So what does that mean then, that we have this traditional gender division of labor? What are the consequences? The first consequence is that if people specialize in unpaid household work, there are some economic risks. And Barbara Bergman is somebody who has written elaborately about this because she believes we should, all women should work full time. There are especially financial risks at divorce, and the figures that, for example, were in Susan Okin's book are actually they're wrong. These figures are mistaken. But there are other studies that, more recent studies that have been done by very skilled economists and quantitative sociologists, and the magnitude of the financial risks is smaller than what was reported in the earlier studies, but we still find that if there is a divorce, that women and children tend to financially lose out and men tend to gain. Now you may ask, how is it possible that somebody can gain? But it is because you have economies of scale when you live together. But then if the husband earns the money, and depending on what the kind of financial arrangement is, there may be an overall loss. So for example, Peterson calculated that in the US, women's standards of living decline between 13 and 35%, and men's standards of living increase between 11 and 13%. And for the UK, Jarvis and Jenkins found that for women and children, it decreases with 14%, and for men, they just say slightly increase for men, decrease for women 14%, for children 18%. So this is, I think, quite an undisputed finding from the literature. However, what cannot be calculated in monetary terms is that upon divorce, there is a serious risk for fathers to lose custody. That, again, depends on the country that you're discussing. For example, two countries with which I'm familiar, Belgium and the Netherlands, have already quite different ways of dealing this. In Belgium, what is sort of an equal custody, co-parenting as it's called, is the dominant way, is the default. Whereas in the Netherlands, we have a much stronger mother ideology, and many fathers lose contact with their children after divorce. And if you believe, or if you endorse the view that being able to raise children is a relational good that cannot be substituted by other intimate relationships, which is the argument that Harry has made, then it does follow that the flourishing of fathers is also jeopardized in cases of divorce, if one is living in countries where the social norms and the legal practice are biased against fathers and in favor of mothers. There have been other arguments made about the consequences of the gender division of labor. One has been an argument that Susan Oaken early on made, that there will be differences in political and societal power, because basically it's not only that women will not be so much present in jobs, but also especially the jobs that where there is power, you will find fewer women. A number of philosophers, Nussbaum, Oaken, and Phillips, have argued that there are also negative consequences for public justice or democracy, because if women are raised in families where they see unequal gender relationships, this may also have an effect on how they will act as democratic citizens. Parents who do not treat each other as equal are likely to raise children who will have a hard time to treat others in society as equal. This is, of course, an empirical claim that I think is hard to study. It's an argument that several philosophers have made, and I present it to you as such I don't know how strong this argument is. However, an argument, the fourth one, or a consequence on which we do have quite a lot of empirical evidence, is discrimination against women workers. In the paper that is available for anybody who wants to read it, I refer to a large number of studies. Actually, these are all, I think, excellent economic studies where discrimination against female workers is documented. This can be either intentional discrimination, but I think it's more likely that it is unintentional and statistical discrimination. But the bottom line is that independent of why people discriminate or whether they're conscious about it or not, they've now found very sophisticated ways to really rule out all other possible explanations, and there is lots of evidence of discrimination against female workers. So that these are the arguments being made in the literature and on which we have empirical evidence. I ask two more, and that is, I've put question marks because I don't know what the answer is, but if anybody has information, I really would welcome you to speak up. The first one is, what are the effects on the well-being of children of an unequal gender division of household holding everything else equal. So I'm not talking about package deals whereby you have a traditional gender division of household, but the real underlying issue is, for example, poverty. No, I'm asking, if you have a family and the family has, for example, favorable conditions for raising children, and they decide either to go for equal division of labor or unequal, does that make a difference for the well-being of the children? I don't know. I don't know of any studies. I have a hypothesis that children may benefit from an equal division of labor, namely that it would increase the likelihoods that they would have good relationships with both their parents. And that, I think, is all other things equal, something valuable. And then the last consequence, also on which I don't have information, but which I think would be relevant, is the question, what are the psychological and emotional consequences for the adults in the division of labor? Are people who work happier or unhappier? I mean, people who hold a job, are people who are able to care happier or unhappier and psychologically healthier? These are, I think, tricky issues, but they do play a role in the public debate. So that's the outcome-based evaluation, the consequences. However, what would philosophers say? They would say, well, this is all interesting, but it is not really very relevant, because the relevant question is, do husband and wives, or do partners, do they have equal opportunities? And are they able to, on equal terms, negotiate or decide on a division of labor which they both prefer? So that would be the kind of argument that, especially in liberal political philosophy, would be given. So the question would shift then from the consequences or the outcomes to the question, are there equal opportunities? I actually think that the outcome-based evaluation is not entirely superfluous. In fact, we will use, we'll come back to it. But I do agree that at an ideal level, the question is really about opportunities. Do people have equal opportunities in deciding to hold jobs or care at home or have part-time jobs or whatever? So that's what I will do next. I will formulate an opportunity-based account of a just societal gender division of labor. So we're working at the level of the society. And I have four conditions that I think need to be met for a situation to be gender just, such that the household division of labor that will follow from it would be just. Anybody who was at my talk yesterday will recognize that, except for the second one, they're basically the same as yesterday, the principles for gender justice, which I think is obvious because the gender division of labor is just a particular instance of the more general issue of gender justice. So the first one, I've called them conditions. I don't know, perhaps they should be principles, but let's now for today stick with conditions. The first one is equal opportunities. The opportunity sets for men and women should be the same. The only inequalities that are justified and are those where human intervention cannot make a difference to the outcome, either by avoiding the outcome, rectifying the situation, or compensating for the inequality. Actually, the principle has changed a little bit compared to yesterday, and that's because at the reception yesterday, Harry convinced me that the other one was wrong. So this one is slightly different, but this one is, I think, correct. The second principle, which is really particular to the gender division of labor, has to do with neutrality between different household arrangements. At the ideal level, I think that justice requires that the basic structure of society, that is, the set of social institutions, should be such that no incentives are introduced against a particular household gender division of labor. Of course, that's a principle that can be overruled if there are good reasons. But in principle, because people should be able to choose the kind of family that they want, there should be neutrality in the way we set up society. The third one is that the constraints on choice from the opportunity set should not be structured according to morally irrelevant characteristics such as gender. So we should not have strong gender ideology that make it very hard for people to choose a particular option. And the last one is that the payoffs of the different options should be just in themselves. So I hope that with these conditions I've been able to capture what I think would be required as a sort of a set of conditions that should be met for background justice. So to say that if these conditions are met, and then a husband and a wife decide on a gender division of labor, whatever they choose, we will accept it as just. The question is, in the societies that we have, are these conditions met? And my answer is, for each of them, no. And I'll try to tell you why I think this is the case. The first condition, the condition of equal opportunities, is not met, and I think a major reason has to do with discrimination. Well, actually, I think you should look at the paper and read all the original studies, but I'll tell you something about the studies. Basically, we have lots of evidence that there are several reasons why women earn less than their husbands, but one of the reasons is gender discrimination. Of course, all the countries that I'm talking about here, they have anti-discrimination legislation, but legislation is one thing, and then what happens in reality is another thing. And there have been some, I really think, some brilliant studies trying to rule out all other explanations and finding whether there was still gender discrimination. There is the famous study by Claudia Golden and Cecilia Roos, where they looked at the way violin players and, I mean, people who play instruments in orchestra have been hired. And they had, so basically they used natural experiments, which is things that happened in society where there is a lot of diversity in the parameters, in the variables, and then they're able to use that diversity, the variance, to answer precisely the question that they want to answer. So in the US, over time, in these kind of auditions, they have introduced a screen, because there was a concern that the appearance of the person who was playing the instrument, which could be the sex of the person or the color of skin, would play a role in whether somebody would be hired or not. And Golden and Roos have found that when the screen was introduced, that the number of women hired was increased dramatically, and part of this increase was, of course, due to the fact that more women applied for this kind of jobs, but there is also an effect that was due to the fact that their gender identity was revealed, so the process had to be really gender neutral. And there are several other studies like that, which I think provide evidence that we still have discrimination. So that means if you have discrimination, then that's already sufficient reason to conclude that the equal opportunities condition is not met, because women just have a harder time getting jobs on the labor market. And of course, the opportunities are not just labor market opportunities. They're also opportunities to stay in the household and, for example, care. And there, I don't know of any studies that have really looked at quantitatively how difficult it is for men to choose to care, but we know from related areas that there are subtle processes working against men caring. Something we also, I think, talked a little bit about yesterday, and we'll talk more about tomorrow. So I think there are opportunity constraints for women on the labor market, and there are opportunity constraints for men in the household, at least when it concerns to caring, if they want to do it. So that's the first condition. The second condition, neutrality, holds that there should be no incentives against one particular household division of labor. Of course, the problem is that the evidence that I used to conclude that the first condition is not met already provides reason to say that the second condition is not met, because if there is discrimination, then it means that it will be harder for couples to decide for an egalitarian division of labor, because the opportunity sets are constrained. But there are other empirical aspects that I think lead us to conclude that the neutrality condition is not met. And one of them, surprisingly enough, has to do with legal aspects. Sometimes we think, okay, on the legal front, everything is organized, is gender just, but it's in the practices, it's in the social norms and so on. But there, even in the, at the legal level, there is no neutrality. And the first, I have two examples, and the first one I already talked about yesterday. This is the maternity leave legislation that we have in most European countries, where after birth we have between 10 and 14 weeks, actually in some Scandinavian countries even many more weeks of fully paid maternity leave. And we do not have the same for men. The case of the Netherlands, which I investigated in detail, we have in total 14 weeks. 4 weeks can be taken before the birth, or you can actually also take 6 weeks, but let's assume it's 4 weeks. Then you have 10 weeks after birth. But from the medical literature, we know that women need, a typical case, need 6 to 8 weeks to recover from childbirth. That means that mothers get another, actually it's 12 weeks then that we have after birth. So that means we have another 4 to 6 weeks that women get after childbirth, which they do not need to recover from childbirth, but which they get because they became mothers, either for the sake of the child or because it's assumed that this is what motherhood requires. Men have the right to 2 days paid parental leave. So I think this is quite, at least in my analysis, it's quite a clear case of a legal discrimination against men. And which, of course, in that period of people's lives, imposes a certain division of labor, but also puts people on a certain track for the years that will follow. So that's the first example of a legal bias. Another example of a legal bias concerns a European court ruling. I don't have the date here, but it was, I think, 2001, roughly around then. The Dutch Ministry of Agriculture had decided that its daycare places would be exclusively reserved for its female employees and male employees that are single fathers. So if you were a male employee and you wanted to bring your child, you could not. There was a shortage of childcare at the time, and the ministry decided that they would give the childcare places to women and to single fathers. And a father went to court and tried to make this undone. However, the European Court of Justice decided that this was allowed. They argued that the ultimate aim of increasing the number of women in the ministry was laudable. And the ruling said that it is the mother's responsibility to secure a place in the nursery, but that given the shortage of high-quality affordable childcare in the Netherlands, they admitted that the ruling could affect that the wives of the male employees working at the ministry had to stay at home, because if they also couldn't find a childcare place, then all the wives of the male employees would have to stay home to care. And the court acknowledged that the measure would could perpetuate a traditional division of roles, but they did not think that this was a strong enough reason to overrule the policy that the ministry had put into place, because they felt that the ministry was entitled to have this kind of gender specialist, gender specific policy. So this is, I think, a very strange case. Um, And then, of course, there are all the... there's also... These are the... So far I've talked about things we can quantify, we can measure, we can... There's legislation, but of course, in the area of gender, many of the things are very subtle, and they have to do with social norms, with cultural coding, and so on. I tend to believe that there's also a factor of habit formation in the case of the gender division of labor. Many men and women find it convenient and attractive to stick to what they see as the dominant gender division of labor, and you could see it as so the traditional gender division of labor is a sort of an intergenerational habit. There is change, but people tend to follow what they see other people following. So to do something radically different than what the majority of the people in society do requires an extra effort and also often requires courage. And I think because the traditional gender division of labor is dominant, that was what I showed at the beginning of the talk, that means that the traditional gender division of labor is the sort of societal default. And that means that there is no neutrality. Of course, the neutrality condition has to do with the social institutions. The government has to be neutral. But even if the government is neutral, we still carry a history with us which makes full neutrality between different divisions of labor very hard. So I think the neutrality condition is not met either. What about the constraints on choice? Here I think the answer is, if you have a sophisticated understanding of what gender is and how gender works, then it's obvious that there are no equal constraints on choice, because one of the things that gender norms and gender structures do is they give you clues about what is appropriate to do for the whether you are a woman or a man. And we have all these masculinity and femininity norms. There are changes and there is diversity, and you have dominant masculinity norms and you have and other types of masculinity norms. But still, to say that there are equal constraints on choice for men and women, I think is shown to be untrue by people who are studying these social norms in the area of gender. And in the case of the gender division of labor, it's also the fact that that the norms are not symmetrical, because the dominant masculinity norms are still such that by holding a job, men can gain this kind of status. But in most Western subcultures, and I think that the higher educated, especially the leftist subculture, is an exception, doing homework and caring is not contributing to masculine identity. And that is, of course, the problem when people say things like what you can find on websites, well, I'm not going to care, I'm not going to stay at home because that's women's work. So when somebody says that's women's work, basically this is a claim that has to do with identity. And the American sociologist Julie Primes has argued that the unemployed husband of unemployed wives in the U.S., tend to do much less domestic work than any other group of men. That's something she found from time analysis data. And she's tried to find why this is the case. So she has all these hypotheses and tried to see which one is the case. And she finds that the hypothesis that by doing domestic work, this would jeopardize their masculinity, which is already being jeopardized by being unemployed, that is an hypothesis that is supported by the empirical material that she has. So I conclude that the third condition is not met either. And then the fourth one, are the payoffs just? Well, I do not think that the payoffs are just because jobs or professions that are coded, that are more populated by female employees, over time often get worse paid. It's not everywhere the case, and not also there's diversity between countries, but especially in the caring sector, like the pay that child care providers get is, for example, very low, and this kind of arguments or this kind of evidence, I think, shows that the payoffs are not just. And also we have also studies that show that within certain professions, so if men and women do exactly the same work, women are worse paid. Actually, one of the arguments is that women don't ask. So there is a book called Women Don't Ask, and the authors of the book argue that women don't ask for pay rises. I've just seen a study for my professional group in the Netherlands. So they did a study about the pay of male and female full professors, and they find if you have the pay range that all the female full professors are here and all the male full professors are there. And so this kind of studies we have for, I mean, there's of course an overlap. It's not that it's dual, but there is an overlap, and but there is, even within one group, you always have a range of pay, and women always tend to be at the bottom, and men tend to be overrepresented at the top. That's what we find from empirical studies in a range of professions. So I believe that the payoffs are also not just. So none of the four conditions are met. Now, the objection. The objection, well, I'll give you the quote in a second. I'll first give you the objection in general. People have said, well, you know, this is all fine, but why do we need these equal opportunity sets? Why do we need these equal constraints? You can also have a situation whereby the opportunity sets for men and women are different, but they're equally attractive, they're equally good. And Carol Pateman has shown that this kind of argument has a long history in political thought. It advocates that men and women take up different roles in life. Their sets of constraints are different, but what they can get is equally good. Actually, there are few contemporary philosophers have argued for this position. Thule has very...
he counts as a contemporary philosopher.
Yes, I know. So, but I have two more quotes. But I'm probably being rude, but I don't take him very seriously. But I do take very seriously Ronald Dworkin and Philip Van Parijs. And Dworkin, I quote you, has said that it's impossible to judge in objective terms whether having a career would be more valuable than to be able to raise children free from the need to work outside the home. So he says you cannot make this kind of judgment. And then there is Philip Van Parijs, who agrees that these kind of gender structures exist, but he denies that they have any normative implications. And the quote that I'm giving you is a response that he wrote to a feminist critique that I wrote of his basic income proposal. So it's actually addressed really to this type of argument. He says, can we imagine such a world without gender preference formation mechanisms and gendered constraints on choice? And if so, should we, women and men, wish to live in it? Whether gender-related or not, the expectations that float around us and that help us shape our behavior, because the expectations that float around us and help shape our behavior because of the importance we attach to fulfilling them are the very stuff of social recognition. It does not make sense to abolish them. And is there a way of making them fair, apart from giving people the right and the power to escape them? True, even an equal power or an equal possibility to give up one's employment in order to look after one's children will not lead to an equal probability if men and women face different expectations with which they wish to comply. I cannot see good reasons for expecting equal probability to be the ideal. So the question is, what should we make of this kind of argument? I've singled out Van Parijs because he was one of the few contemporary liberal political philosophers who really has stated what he thinks. Most have actually not stated what they think, except for like Dworkin in one line. But I'm responding to Van Parijs, but I'm also trying to respond to this general idea that the opportunity sets may be different but equally good. So what is the challenge that this argument poses for my analysis? The counter-argument or the objection entails that for an opportunity-based evaluation, such as the one that I've presented, it's not enough to show that the constraints on choice are gender-dependent, because it could be that the constraints are different, but that they're equally fair and thus they're just. Put differently, it is possible that the constraints limit men's and women's freedom or options to the same degree, but in different ways and in different directions. Therefore, to prove that the gender division of labor does not pass the equal opportunity test, we would also have to show that the constraints on the opportunity sets in general advantage men and disadvantage women, or we could also do it the other way around, but they advantage one group and disadvantage the other group. And I believe I can show this to be the case. I believe that the constraints on choice are predominantly facilitating or positive for men and predominantly negative or hampering for women. Not everything. It's not black-white. I gave already the example of child custody, but I think on balance, this is what I would argue for. And how can I make that case? Well, the first argument is that if you look at the outcome-based evaluation, most of the risks and the negative aspects are found on the side of women who specialize in unpaid labor. But you may think that this is not enough evidence or not enough arguments. So I give you two more arguments. Why I think that on the whole, women tend to lose and men tend to gain. The first is that women have organized themselves in the women's movement to change these gender constraints. But in contrast, we do not see men arguing that the gender constraints act to their disadvantage. I would argue that if men would feel systematically disadvantaged or unfair constrained by the expectations that gender puts on them, we would expect that men would also organize themselves and fight against these social structures just as women did in the women's movement. Of course, there are men who do this, but they are numerically a very, very small number. We also know from studies that more women than men favor an equal sharing of paid and unpaid work, that more women than men would want to make their household division of labor more equal, and that more women than men are unsatisfied with the current division of labor in their households. Marion Ferber has argued that men have a stake in preserving the traditions and the status quo because many don't see much to be gained from doing more household work. And some have also argued that you cannot understand this whole situation of the gender division of labor if you are not willing to think in terms of privileged positions. Qualitative research done by a sociologist has shown that many women actually struggle to make their partner do more household and care work. They struggle to get the division changed, but they counter resistance and they find it very difficult and many give up. Thus, I think there is some empirical evidence that the current division of labor is serving men's interests more than women's interests. And if that is true, then of course it's completely understandable and rational for men that they do not try to change this because it's a good deal for them. Of course, one could counter-argue to this argument that this lack of complaint or lack of political organization argument doesn't work, because the counter-argument or the objection would be that we cannot deduce from this lack of complaint that there are no negative effects of the gender constraints on men's life. And the argument would go like this. Well, actually, the argument would basically say a lack of protest should not be taken as conclusive evidence for a lack of injustice, because just as we argue for some other groups, men may suffer from some form of false consciousness and they may not realize how badly the gender constraints affect their well-being. That is an argument, but I do think we have reason to think that it doesn't apply to this case, namely, there is lack of protest by men on the outcomes of the gender division of labor, and that is in the case of custody. In the cases where there's clear evidence that the set of gender constraints does harm men's interests. Men do resist the gender constraints. And I think that the case of divorced fathers who are getting well organized, that and they are fighting against the mother ideology that gives custody to over the children to mothers, that this is a good illustration of the fact that if men, the affected group of men, lose out from the gender division of labor and the consequences of the gender division of labor, that then they do get organized. Hence, I would conclude in the situation where men feel that they are worst off, they do raise their voices, but in that they do not raise their voices in the other cases because these are situations where the gender constraints gives them a more favorable outcome. And there is another reason, a third response to Van Parijs, and that is that the last reason why gender constraints in general and gender norms in particular disadvantage women has to do with the fact that people who are not doing a substantial part of housework or bearing the responsibility for it, and same for care work, tend to underestimate and undervalue this kind of work. Well, I claim, but we may disagree about this, that the societies about which we are talking undervalue unpaid work and especially care work, not only in financial terms, but also with regard to recognition and respect for that work. There is some, I would call it suggestive qualitative evidence for this claim. There has been a project in Iceland where in Reykjavik they set up an experiment with giving fathers parental leave before, they introduced a couple of years ago parental leave 3 months for all fathers paid. But before that, they started a project. And because it was an experiment, they also interviewed the fathers. They interviewed them before birth, during the leave, after the leave. And one of the things that came clear out of that study was that men who took this leave were very surprised to find out how demanding it was, how demanding caring was, but also housework, and they started to value it much more. So the men who took part in this project said things like that even if they went back to work, they really had much more respect and valuation for what the women then did. And in the Netherlands, we have a sociologist who specialized in studying caring fathers. The Netherlands has the highest percentage worldwide of men working part-time. Vincent Duindam is his name, and he actually claims that he found the same, so that men are surprised at how demanding they find it is, but they also, many of them also find that the relations they have with their children are much better. So that's also a positive finding that he finds. So I would think that if people are sticking to traditional gender roles, and they are at the side where they are doing the paid work, that they will underestimate and also probably undervalue the work that is being done. And in such a situation, saying that the traditional female role is different but equally good, I think is then based on romanticized notions of domestic work, and really I see this as a rationalization of a social arrangement which serves these people well. Now, so I come to the conclusion that the societal gender division of labor is unjust. What does this mean for particular households? Well, there are two options. Either the societal gender division of labor is just, that is the utopia we will perhaps one day reach, then whatever individual household division of labor people decide to have is just. So if these conditions are met and people decide to have equal parenting or equal division of labor or traditional or reverse, it doesn't matter because the conditions are met and then people, the background conditions of justice are met and then whatever individual households decide to do is just. But that, if my empirical analysis is correct, is now not the case. So we're at the second level, the societal gender division of labor is unjust. Then I think I cannot give you any overall statements. I can just make a few points. The first is that in the unjust situation in which we are right now, the traditional gender division of labor may be the best thing to do for a particular household. Why? Because gender justice is not the only value. And for example, if there is no good, if there are no part-time jobs available, if there's no good childcare available, then and a couple has children, then they may decide that for the sake of the children, it is best if they have a traditional gender division of labor. So I think that is just very clear. It may be the best thing to do in a certain situation. Another reason could be, for example, if healthcare benefits are only attached to full-time jobs, and a family is not able to combine two full-time jobs, then again, because healthcare is a very important good, it may be, all things considered, the best thing to do to have a traditional gender division of labor at the household level. I think it is very difficult to judge for a particular case whether a particular case where you have a traditional gender division of labor, whether it's unjust or not. And the reason is that we don't know the kind of, we don't know why this outcome emerged. It may be that it is because of strong gender norms. It may be that it is because of differences in preferences or other things. So it is just for individual cases. If you cannot open the people's brains and look inside, or if you don't have detailed ethnographic information on the gender norms and so on, it is just difficult to say. I do think that even when the societal gender division of labor is unjust, an egalitarian division of labor is possible in many cases, but it will always come at extra costs. And one of the costs is that the habits or the most prevailing structures are facilitating traditional gender division of labor. And depending on the country that we're talking about, these extra costs can be small or they can be big. For example, in the Netherlands, on which I know the details best, right now it is not so difficult to have an egalitarian division of labor. But 10 years ago, when the childcare facilities were much, much more restricted, it was much more difficult, because 10 years ago, to have an egalitarian division of labor, you needed to have grandparents living close by, or you needed to have some other type of quality childcare arrangement. Now this institution has been put in place, and now I think, I mean, of course, it's still, if you have children, it's still an everyday struggle, but it is possible to have an egalitarian gender division of labor. So it depends on all these institutions that are available or not available. And the last point that I want to make is that if there is no background justice, then I think that individuals who use their, what I would call their gender privilege, the fact that social norms are backing them up to do something, that individuals who are using this gender privilege when they are negotiating or deciding on the household gender division of labor, that this is an unjust individual act. So I think individuals can decide to get the most out of it for themselves, to get what serves their interest best, or they can decide to go for an arrangement that is just. And basically, I'm here supporting people like my colleagues Joel Anderson and Pauline Klanghout, who've argued that there's always justice within the family. We may try to ignore it or try to think there are no questions of justice in the family. The questions are there. The question is, do we acknowledge that there are questions of justice in the family, or do we try to avoid putting decisions in the light of justice and play it in a way that serves our own interests? So I think that the gender division of labor, and here I end where I started yesterday, shows us an example of why justice is not just about the government. Justice is also about what we do in our individual and household and collective decisions.